Everyone. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being here for our second Sundays with Andy tour program, in which we invite a prominent local artist to come and give their perspective on Andy Warhol the last decade. Our speaker today is Los Angeles-based artist James Gilbert, whose works span many media, including performance, video, installation, in addition to drawing and painting. His work has shown widely in the United States and Asia. Future projects for 2010 and beyond in the U.S., Denmark, and Colombia. His local connection, he has just completed a stint as the artist-in-residence at Central Track at UT Dallas and was shown at the MAC in 2009. And currently, his large-scale, site-specific installation, Warnings and Instructions, which includes video and constructed environment, can be seen at the Dallas Contemporary through April 18th. This solo work was chosen to inaugurate the Dallas Contemporary's new space in a repurposed industrial building. I'm going to turn it over to James now. You can learn more about he and his work at jamesgilbertstudio.com. Everyone, James Gilbert.
You guys are clapping. You haven't even heard anything yet. This is great. This is a good start. Thank you for all showing up on Sunday afternoon. I'm going to just tell you a little bit about myself before we go into start to see the exhibition. So thank you for the moderator for having me. I thought it was a cool opportunity to be invited to do this because my work has to deal with a lot of identity-based issues and privacy issues. And so it was a great idea to kind of be asked to do this because Andy Warhol spent a lot of time dealing with celebrity and other issues. So I deal with those in a slightly different way. We'll talk a little bit about my work as we go through it, but I primarily want to talk about what Andy's work is and kind of the art practice coming from my point of view as we kind of walk through. So if you don't mind, let's go to that back room and we'll go from there. By the way, before we go, if you have any questions throughout, feel free to ask me. Then we'll answer some questions during, then also after. Okay, cool. Let's go to this room. I think if we start, we face this way a little bit, and we'll kind of do, I'll stand here and I'll give a general kind of assessment of this room. Thank you. So what I can tell you right now, as we walk through, you're going to see some of Andy's work that's very atypical, stuff that we maybe haven't seen before. But I think this show is very exciting for that way, because it's showing lots of stuff that he's not necessarily known for, but I think it's made during a part of his life. That maybe we don't know as much about. But I think it's exciting from the viewpoint that we're dealing with some other issues as an artist. I wanted to call attention to, we all know Andy, his soup cans, his flowers, his portraits. I mean, he's up to this point, he's in this last 10 years of his life, he's very much kind of a court painter. He's painting all the people of the day. He's painting society portraits. And at this point, he's, you know, the last 10 years of his life, he's in his 50s, okay? Things are starting to happen. He's looking for, he's had his highs and lows of his career. He's starting to see a new energy that's starting to happen around him in New York. So I wanted to call attention as an artist, what is happening like psychologically to an artist when you get later into your career, what happens, what doesn't happen. When I first walked into this room, I immediately noticed all the self-portraits. We know Andy Warhol's done lots of self-portraits. And all of a sudden we start to see a different dynamic for me when I'm assessing these. The first one, he's getting strangled. The second ones are dealing with these psychological things. This wall very much dealing with icons he's been painting for the day. So that was my first reaction. I'm like, okay, well, we know the self-portraits. Some of these I've seen, some of these haven't seen. And all of a sudden, I look at this wall. And it goes, this doesn't make any sense to me. Why is this whole wall of celebrities and pictures here? Well, that's very much what his lifestyle was. He was surrounded by these personalities. He was dealing with those things. He was dealing with celebrity. But I think all of a sudden, he's in his 50s, and he's dealing with these new issues in his own psychology and his work. So he's used to that, but all of a sudden, he has to get to a deeper meaning. At this point, you have to think about what's happening in New York. He's been shot, you know, tried to be assassinated. He's seen all these young, sexy artists kind of growing up and kind of reinventing their careers. He goes, where am I in this whole picture? So me as an artist, I'm looking at it, geez, he's way deep into his career. Where's the meaning as an artist? You got your highs and lows. Where do we reinvent it? So immediately you're looking at like, wait a minute, the first piece is there's shadows. Okay? Well, what's in shadows? It's a search for a deeper meaning. It's a search for a Rorschach. What's there, what's not there? And I think it's a good way to kick off the psychological energy of what he was actually doing in terms of his self-portrait. I know everybody knows this painting because it's part of the collection here. I look at self-portraits, and I'm thinking, I don't think they should be called self-portraits. I think they should be called self-confrontations. That's definitely what they are. You're looking at them, and not only self-portraits, the idea for me on when I look at these, for any artist that does them, you want it to be an accurate representation of what you look like as a portrait. You want it to be recognizable. But I think it's dealing with so much more than that. It's dealing with like the psychology. It's dealing with him in a time and place. I'm looking at this portrait and made in the last 10 years of his life, thinking, wait a minute, what is going on with his life, his association with all these celebrities? Does he want to be part of that? Where is he at in his own career? Where is he, you know? And so I look at that picture and I think he's definitely dealing with his psychology in this one. You know, he's got the teased out hair that comes with his associations with probably Basquiat. But he's definitely, when I think of doing portraits or representations of myself, I have to deal with my time and place and my psychology. So I think this is a great way to start this show in terms of where he's at and what we're going to see in the next several rooms. So let's go to the next room if you don't mind. Like I said, feel free to ask if you have any questions as you go through. On three, let's rush this small crowd to get them out of the way. I'm teasing you guys. Finish up. You guys finish up. What I want to address in this room, and this is some work I have to say that is very new. We're looking over to your left and your right. We're looking at these oxidation paintings. These paintings were designed. They're actually urine paintings. They're piss paintings. And when I look at this, you kind of understand how aware Andy Warhol was, not only in his time and place, but aware of himself and the work that he was making. Back at a little bit of history, I'm not going to come from a historical viewpoint at all, so don't correct me, don't fact check me, I have to tell you that right now. But in the 60s, he was making these paintings, he was kind of peeing on these paintings, very much saying, hey, look, painting is dead. He's going to renounce paintings a few years later and say, hey, that's where it's at, I'm going to start making films. Well, I think he was certainly aware of what maybe a Duchamp was making or something like that, where they'd actually have these kind of these piss parties, these fountain parties, where people would come in and pee on the paintings. So he was certainly making a reference, I think, to that. But I think ultimately what happens much, much later, in the 70s when he's doing these paintings, he's like, wait a minute, I haven't painted, I haven't used my hand in a long time. I've been making films, I've been making screen prints, I haven't used the object yet. So I think he wants to reinvigorate, how do I re-energize myself into painting again. Well, all of a sudden he's making these piss paintings. It's a different abstraction of a brush. It's not an extension of your hand. All of a sudden he's using a different brush. And then all of a sudden he's making these. So I really kind of value as artist, all of a sudden he's willing to be brave enough to kind of go way beyond what he'd have been making, what he was known for, and say, hey, look, I'm going to take myself out of that. I'm going to do an experimentation. If I can do a little bit of a slide, I think all artists should be allowed that certain amount of experimentation, because that's where the interesting work really starts to happen. If he was just cycled through, let's make more soup cans, let's make more Marilyns, let's make more Elvises, he needs to go through that process to get to this. And I think this is kind of in the early stage of that process, the experimentation. Going back to the portrait, he was also experimenting in his own kind of psychology. Where am I in my career, and how do I get to the next level? The Rorschach paintings, the same thing as we all understand when we're growing up, we make the inkblot test. It's very much, again, a search for deeper meaning, what was happening potentially in his life. As an artist, I can see, hey, look, there's lots of stuff that's not going to work, there's some stuff that is going to work, but I need to do that experimentation to take me to the next level. So very much these three paintings and this body of work all of a sudden deals with that abstraction, but a deeper meaning. So let's move on to these next paintings. Actually, if you guys was to turn around, I'll work my way over here so you guys don't have to move. I'll do this if you don't mind, so you can see me. So these paintings right here, another kind of small history. When Warhol was coming to New York in the 50s, Jackson Pollock was already kind of he was the art star. And there's a big Life magazine that says, hey, look, is Jackson Pollock the greatest living artist? I gotta believe that Warhol was aware of that. He was very much aware of art history, very much of his surroundings, and very much aware of pop culture and the zeitgeist of the moment. We know that from his work. So I'm looking at these paintings, and I'm thinking, the first thing I look at, I'm like, I have never seen these before. I'll admit it, never seen them. then I think, well, these are Jackson Pollocks. I kind of started reading a little bit about him, and they're coming from, he was commissioned to do some work for a yarn company. So I don't know what the first incarnations were. I've never seen him. I don't know anybody else has seen him. But all of a sudden I'm thinking, well, it's Jackson Pollock. And I think it's his way, of playing an homage to Jackson Pollock in the way he kind of made his drip paintings and things like that. Really quick side story. Don't know if this is true or not, but repeat it because I like this story. It used to be a derogatory term, the way I understand it. If you would see somebody and they were making a bad painting, it was sloppy, it was messy. It was like, you're like, that guy's painting soup. That guy's junk. And so Jackson Pollock was the original guy that was like, hey, that guy's just painting junk. It's soup. So Andy Warhol, very aware of the moment and very aware of the dialogue that was happening at the time, starts making the soup cans. True or not, I don't know, but I like it. You can repeat it. So I think he's actually kind of making a reference in terms of his history, making the early piss paintings maybe a reference to Duchamp. These also maybe a reference to Jackson Pollock. Okay? Looking for kind of a deeper kind of substance in the work he's doing. Kirsten, so far?
So was he using the yarn to make the drips? Is that
the way it came about? I think on these, what he does is he incorporates his practice, his art practice is the word that we all use in our studio. What do? How do we make our marks? How do we communicate what we're doing? So he translates his ideas traditionally as a printmaker, as a screen printer, filmmaking, making drawings, and he takes those ideas, puts the yarn down, photographs it like he normally does, makes his screen, then makes these, is the way I understand this process. Okay, so he's still incorporating his art practice, but he's taking that dialogue, what's going on around the world right now, into these pieces. Okay, I want to go a little bit further into this room. Come further to this room, we're going to go around. A lot of people behind you. Come on in. We got almost everybody, it looks like. What I have to say, what can happen in an artist's studio and the way it's kind of communicated later in the history books, museum shows, curators, things like that, there's a lot of stuff that can get communicated accurately, and there's some stuff that they'll never know. Okay, there's things that happen in my studio that no one's ever going to know about. Way to make decisions, way things are accidents that happen, way things are kind of fluky, you know. It just doesn't happen. I mean, not all that eventually makes it into the interpretation of the work later. I think when someone like Andy Warhol, his work has been so researched, has so many books about him, a lot of that comes out. That there, can we ever possibly know what happens in the studio? I don't think so. So I think what we're doing is we're getting into a part of the work, I think that kind of falls a little bit into that category. Again, dealing back with the Rorschach paintings, he's definitely looking for some meaning. The way he kind of came about ideas, who he surrounded himself with, the way he exchanged ideas, certainly kind of led into that. I think he's very much at this point in his career kind of dealing with, how do I get to deeper meaning in my life? I'm getting older. I'm starting to get kind of dealing with my own kind of personal issues. I'm dealing with my own kind of psychology. I'm dealing with all my own religious beliefs and things like that. So I think he's certainly looking at a painting like this. When I look at this, I'm not, like I said, not addressing it from a historical viewpoint. He's looking at this work and say, it's exciting. It's a large-scale piece. I've been making large-scale pieces, but all of a sudden it's reinvigorating. He's actually on his hands and knees again working on pieces in terms of having his factory. As an artist, when you come upon an idea, all you want to do is make a lot of them, okay? Whether they're good or bad, you would just want to sort through those ideas as quickly as possible and then kind of go away from them and come back and see if they're working. I could imagine if I was standing in front of this work and all of a sudden I was unrolling these 14-foot canvases, I'm like, that's exciting. I can't go wait to do another one and just put them all in, set up in my studio. Leave them, show them, I don't know. But I think that would probably have been an exciting kind of moment for Warhol. How they were doing these inkblot tests, we all know how they do it. You take a big sheet of paper, and then you kind of put ink on one side, and then you kind of fold it over. Well, this is a physical act to make a painting this size. When you're folding over, you're pressing it, you're rolling it. So I think it was exciting for Annie, who's getting a little bit older, and it's kind of way reinvigorated his sense of kind of like the physical act of making objects and making paintings. So going on to the ones on the right and left. By the way, I have to say, the way the show is curated, I have to, just before I get too far, I think it's really smart the way they laid this out, the way they kind of communicate all these ideas throughout. So I just had to throw that out there. All of a sudden, we're looking at these egg paintings. We're like, what is going on with egg paintings? Why would he go such a strange kind of, a strange direction from all the work that we already know? Again, I think he's very much in this experimental phase, very much kind of trying to search for a deeper meaning. Well, now that he's died, we know a little bit of his history, his little bit of his religious beliefs. I'm thinking, these kind of, and all of a sudden we can look at them as dot paintings, which were happening at the time. All of a sudden, I think there's more to them. They're eggs, okay? The eggs are a symbol of rebirth, they're a symbol of Easter. You know, he practiced regularly. You know, I think it's a way of kind of like I said, a rebirth. I think it's certainly this phase in his life. He doesn't know that he's going to die anytime soon, but he's certainly dealing with those kind of issues of like all these young, sexy painters coming up. He needs to readdress why he's still making objects, you know, for himself. So I think the Rorschach and the eggs being in the same room, I think is a really smart choice, the way they present them in terms of how he's dealing with representing his ideas and exploring things. So if you don't, do we have any questions so far? Anything? No? Okay, good. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to go out, follow the guy with the stand over there. Thank you. And we're just going to kind of quickly pass through this room, then we're going to go to the larger room. Let's stop right here. I mean, we're going to be in this room. Thank you. I don't know. I just thought of this. There's this... There's this funny thing in art practice, when you make objects, you're just so used to kind of handling things and touching things like that. I think everybody trusts me here, so I'm fine. I'm not going to touch anything. But, you know, as visitors, too, all of a sudden we see pieces like this, and you want to kind of go up and kind of have a physical interaction with them, because I've made paintings and things like that. I can know what it's like to stand in front of this object, to be like 2 feet away from it. All of a sudden we get into this kind of environment, we kind of push back. So, you know, I think that also gets into a different experiential quality when we look at work, that we're actually not experiencing it, maybe perhaps the way the artist was making it. But it's always kind of a funny thing to me how we treat stuff in our studios versus how they actually end up being displayed. People don't know that there was probably a stack of bananas, a couple bottles of beer right here, and they're walking across it in their studio, but all of a sudden we can't get within, what is this, 3 feet in front of it. This next work, just so you know, he did this collaboration with Jean-Michel Basquiat. It was a collaboration that was brought together a little bit by his dealer. At the time, and at the time, you know, it was probably great for both of them. You know, Andy needed to be reinvigorated. He needed to see engage with the art scene again. And all of a sudden, there's this young painter, Jean-Michel Basquiat, who was kind of up and coming and is kind of energized. So I think the two of them, they started this collaboration where they each start a section of the painting, then the other one would come back and work on top of it. Andy very much stylistically was working very clean, dealing with screen prints, and Jean-Michel Basquiat, who was very loose and gestural kind of erratic in kind of the way he kind of placed his marks, all of a sudden brought a new energy to Warhol. And I can certainly see that when you deal with collaborations, they can be exciting from the viewpoint where all of a sudden someone presents an idea, the way they put down a mark that's very different than they would normally would. And I think this collaboration just between a very established and a very famous Warhols and a very young kind of artist had to be exciting for both of them. So there's other collaborations in the next room that I want to talk a little bit more about, but that's just where we're at. We're going to take a left here into this next room.
Why the linen? Why the acrylic on linen? Is it the way it absorbs the...
Yeah, I'll answer that here, yeah, I think maybe. Yeah.
Thank you.
I think if everybody kind of gets kind of central, what we'll do is I'm going to turn you around a couple times in this room. As I was walking through here, I was asking a question, why the acrylic on linen? I could tell you 1,000 different things that happened in an artist's studio that you can kind of project later on in terms of history, why or why not. I could tell you I can only tell you from my perspective on why something like that would happen. You have two artists who are very frenetic. You're side by side and you're working, okay? Well, oil paint dries naturally a lot slower than an acrylic paint, okay? So that could be part of the reason. They both were used to kind of working with materials. It could be materials that they're very familiar with. It could be materials that they get excited and it just happens to be there. Basquiat was known very much for like whatever surface is there, whatever paint is there, he's going to use. So I think it led a lot of energy perhaps to maybe Warhol. What else can happen in an artist's studio? Stuff you have around. Oh, stuff that you go to the art supply store and you want to get a ton of this red paint, they don't have it, you're like, all right, I'll get that red paint instead. You can wait it out, or you're like, this one's on sale, I need to get 25 tubes of it, and you buy it. It happens in peculiar ways. And so all of a sudden you look, an art historian 10 years from now, and you say, hey, look, you know, Basquiat only used this color green, this Kelly green. Maybe that's what he found. Maybe he had a big bucket of that paint. So things happen in an artist's studio that we can't predict. We can't logically say, he chose that green because of this reason. So hopefully that answers the question that we had earlier. How kind of in art practices, it can be unpredictable, and that can be the exciting things about discovery, where you don't have what you need. All of a sudden, you take a new material and you reinvent it. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about a couple different pieces in this room. You guys are all fine where you're at, but if you can just kind of turn around, you see that one on the far back corner. This is the continuation of the collaborative series that Warhol did with Basquiat and Clemente. You can see their marks individually. I think the relationship with Clemente didn't last as long as Warhol and Basquiat. They had a longer friendship and a longer collaboration. But you can kind of see, you can pick out, on that particular piece, you can kind of pick out whose mark is making what. And I, like I said, it had to be invigorating for all the artists to kind of say, hey, look, I never would have thought to make that mark. I never would have thought to kind of work over somebody else's piece like that. So it can be a good thing or a bad thing. I don't know how it worked for Clemente. He didn't last very long. I don't know, but maybe it was a different agreement. But what I want to talk about, we're going to continue the collaboration, but since everybody's facing this way, I want to kind of turn focus to these black and white ads. There's a thing that happens also in the artist's studio as we kind of develop our practice. Someone says, hey, that really works for me. That the stuff that you're making right now, it's really great. Why don't you go make 1,000 more of them, just sell a ton of them. You're good to go. Well, as artists, our moods change, you know? We all have different interests in politics, different interests in religion, current events, things like that. So I think as culturally, we need to allow artists that are kind of have a career that remain curious to kind of continue to produce work that remains interesting to them so they can have their new breakthroughs and we can see something interesting. We, you know, as we're just so kind of, you know, in the last several years in the art market, it was very commerce driven. And they're saying, get it out, get it out, get it out, make it, sell it, sell it, sell it. What that can be bad for all of us. That can be bad for the artist in terms of getting new ideas and also bad for the people that are looking at it. You know, I can tell you from my perspective only, waking up to make objects or to make paintings or drawings or pieces, it's a brave existence. And I'm not saying that to for my own benefit. I'm just saying that every day you wake up and you want to make something that's original. You want to make something that's unique. You want something that you've never seen. You want to entertain yourself. You want to make something that no one else has ever seen. And that's hard to do because people want sometimes it can be too challenging. It's not the familiar, which we all like. So in terms of talking about like kind of that bravery process, it kind of lends itself also to a very kind of lonely existence, also kind of self-doubt. And that's why I'm saying as a community, we have to allow our artists to say, hey, look, you need to experiment. Because you know, we know you're going to get to an interesting place. You're going to make some stuff we're not going to like, and we're going to hate it. But I think it's important for as the greater art dialogue and culturally to say, hey, look, let's expand our ideas. Let's move out of the ordinary. One thing that I have, I don't have, my work is not necessarily tied to Andy Warhol's in any particular way, other than my interest in identity and celebrity. Very different than what Warhol's was doing. But I have a small little tear out in my studio that's kind of by my light switch. I see it some days, I don't see it some days, even though I use that same light switch every day. And it's a smaller tear out, probably from Artform or something like that, 8x10. And it's a portrait of Warhol in his silk screen, and he's eating a banana. And, you know, very direct, but the quote on it says, art is what you can get away with. And when I look at that, I don't think, hey, look, Andy Warhol is trying to dupe anybody. I think what he was, to me, what that way that translates to me is, it's not what you can get away with, it's like how far you can push your materials, how far can you push yourself outside of what you're doing, how far can you kind of make something new, and kind of really kind of convince people, like, look, it's okay to think differently. How do you use these objects in a different way that we've never seen before? So anyway, all that back aside, when I come back to these black and white ads, all of a sudden I look at these, and we all know Andy Warhol as like the craftsman, as the screen printer and things like this, but these are actually the part of the process, what he did on this. He actually made paintings by hand, shot the acetates, and then kind of silkscreened them back. So he kind of has this kind of dual purpose thing that he's doing on these. What I find interesting, all of a sudden we look at it and say, hey, look, he has multiple interests in the same piece practically, okay? He's dealing with some pop culture issues, he's dealing with some fads, he's dealing with culture, he's dealing with a little bit of religion, a little bit of politics. This happens around all of us. We don't just have one dialogue. And as an artist, you just have one dialogue. You make the Rothko paintings every day of your life. That works for you? Great. I'm saying most people doesn't work that way. And so I think this is really great, and it's brave of him to kind of actually go ahead and try to make these pieces for himself. So what I want to do is I want to turn around, look over here. Any questions real fast? Nothing? Okay. This is another collaboration with Basquiat. Think in terms of collaborations, in terms of how they would work. The way these would work, one person would start a piece, and then another person would come in and add to it. Collaborations are difficult for this reason. That's funny. I heard someone laugh over here because they know my association with collaborations. As all artists, we have a bit of ego, we want to do our own marks, and this is why I'm going to get into why collaborations can be difficult. You have to have a lot of trust with your collaborator. You have to know that you're going to put down a mark and the person's going to come by and make another mark on top of it and maybe potentially ruin it. So just think of it this way. And I invite everybody in this room to go do this with a partner or a friend or something later this afternoon. You go home, you take an 8x10 sheet of paper, have your friend take one. You start. Don't have a plan out. You guys each make a drawing, trade it with your friends. Do that 2 or 3 times. I guarantee at the end of it, you're going to be mad that they drew over your best part of your drawing. I guarantee it. Don't even get color involved because it's even going to get worse, I tell you. Okay, so I think this is definitely a trust issue. You know, you got Warhol in his 50s, Basquiat, much, much younger, half his age. All of a sudden he says, hey, look, I'm going to start making this mark. And I'm going to turn around and I'm going to work on this canvas and you put something over it. He's like, ah, dude, why'd you put this right here, man? But you have to do that because there's a certain amount of layering and context that happens when you layer things that maybe Warhol wouldn't expect that, hey, why would you do that? And all of a sudden you could see the layers of paint that kind of pop out from behind it that he wouldn't have ever normally done and his very clean kind of screen prints. So maybe that was very exciting to him. All of a sudden you get to these words down here, and that all of a sudden Basquiat's putting stuff over or Warhol's putting things. I think a successful collaboration is we don't know whose hand did what. I think in this piece you can kind of pick up pieces, who did what. I can definitely see this as kind of being a Basquiat piece, and this is kind of being Basquiat. I can definitely see part of this being Warhol. I have to tell you, I looked at this square right here quite a bit when I previewed the show the other day. I honestly don't know who did this white square. And the reason I ask is because it seems like a very loose kind of experience in terms of the way the brushwork was applied. I'm like, wow, do I know Warhol to be doing that kind of work? And I'm like, no, I'm not really sure because that was more a Basquiat thing. And then I turn around and I look at this painting kind of right here. And this was actually when Warhol was actually kind of going back and he was kind of doing these loose kind of these paintings by hand. And he wasn't using the mechanics of screen prints anymore. I'm going like, wait a minute, that's pretty loose. That makes sense. I'm like, maybe he did make this. So I started relating, like, what is really happening in kind of an artist's studio, and how can we predict, oh, that guy made that mark, that guy made this mark, and this is what his intentions were. I'm saying, I don't think that's entirely possible 100% of the time. But, you know, so it's exciting to see a collaboration, the way this works, and the way kind of the interplay in terms of, well, one more thing before I forget. When you make a collaboration, there's a certain amount of physical space you have to allow your collaborator on the object that you're making. And there's a lot of trust and a lot of psychological space you have to allow your partner. If Warhol came in and did the whole thing, well, we know from the way Basquiat works, he would have covered it. But he has to allow for a new piece right here. And they have to allow for each other to kind of room to create and grow. It's kind of very much like a dialogue. You say one thing, they say one thing. Some things are memorable in the dialogue. Some things you're just going to forget 2 hours later. Ultimately, at the end of the collaboration, there's plot points in your dialogue that you're going to remember. And that's when you know, that's when your piece may be done. Okay? Any questions just yet? I'm either rocking it out or no one's listening. I don't know. Okay. We're going to take a left. Okay? I think in this room we'll also do another thing where we stand in the center and we're going to turn around and talk about a few things. Good looking crowd. All right. So in this room, all of a sudden, we're kind of getting close to kind of near the end. So like I said, if you have any questions, we're going to go to this room. We're going to talk in here. It's a big crowd for that room, so I'll cover that painting from here. Then what we're going to do is we're going to go all the way out, stand out on the outside, and then I'll wrap it up over there. All of a sudden, we're looking at, you know, near the last few years of Warhol's life. Again, he doesn't know. He knows his physical health is failing a little bit. He knows one of his best friends, his collaborator, Jean-Michel Basquiat, they're no longer kind of collaborating anymore. It was a special relationship for them. It was kind of, so they're not together anymore. He knows his health is failing. He knows his partner, his health is failing in terms of... So I think at this point, he's looking at, again, addressing his own psychology and his own kind of morality and his own kind of personal issues that he's really kind of, he wants to explore. I mean, I look at this work as very much his personal work. So all of a sudden, we're getting into the Last Supper. I'm looking at this as the ultimate disaster painting, and I'll tell you why. We know Warhol's in the first room. We're going to bring it back there where he was dealing with the skulls. He was dealing with his own psychology where he was strangling himself. You know, his later work, which is not in this show, some of the pieces that had to do with electric chairs, crash sites, things like that. He's aware of these things. He's got guns. He's dealing with camouflage. He's lots of different kind of like psychological, heavily loaded kind of pieces. Well, we all know the story here, okay? So it's heavily loaded. This is part of the commission, by the way. And it has a lot of baggage to it. I'm looking at this painting going, wait a minute. He's certainly aware of it because we know he's aware of art history. He's making maybe perhaps earlier with the Duchamp, the Picasso, the Jackson Pollock. Now he's dealing with Leonardo da Vinci as a disaster. Reason I call this a disaster is because we know the story. We know what's happening the next day, okay? Warhol, I think, is part commissioned, so he's asked to do this, but we know he's going to be dealing with those things psychologically. And so I look at this and kind of say, hey, look, he's definitely coming to terms where he's at in his life at this point in his career. So I'm going to turn around and say, look at this one right here behind you. He's coming back to these religious figures, okay? For the first time in his life, he's starting to kind of address, in his private work, where he feels religiously, a very important part of his kind of career. But he's also bringing in all these other elements. You know, and in a way, this is almost like a greatest hits. He's dealing with the Last Supper, he's dealing with religious, he's dealing with icons. Iconography is a big part of his life, but he's also bringing a lot of deeper meaning into this. The Big C, we talked about potentially what that could be. It could be its representation, this is the big Christ. It could be the cancer, because AIDS was starting to kind of be prevalent in New York at the time, and they didn't have another word for it. All this stuff you can kind of probably read up on and kind of fact check me and see if this is... But I think very much for him, working on this scale and kind of all of a sudden a culmination of so many different ideas puts him in a spot where he's so self-aware that he's actually in a good spot in his life. And I have to say this, I don't know, but I can see how this could be a really fulfilling kind of object to make privately, is the way he was doing this. So off to our left is, okay, I'm going to admit something. When I first saw this painting in this room, I didn't get it. It didn't make any sense to me, because this is another Warhol-Basquiat collaboration. Then this is where I'm giving a lot of street cred to the curators of the show. It really makes a lot of sense. It's his collaboration. Like I said, he's dealing with the fallout of this long-term collaborator, Basquiat. He's also addressing kind of these other kind of these very personal issues in his life. And then you look at this and you're like, wait a minute. You could see, this one's more definitive in terms of what you can see in the Basquiat's hand, in terms of Warhol's hand. All of a sudden you see, and sin no more. Okay, well, he's definitely dealing with this very repentive thing, dealing with this last part of his life, whether he knows it or not. Just so you know, Warhol is going to die within probably a year of these paintings, and which is a very productive year, his last few years. Is that correct, Terry? Is that right? Thank you. Sure. The question is, why is there two? The question is, why is there two different panels, and are they any different, and is there any difference? Well, you know, we all know that part of his art practice, so I can start here if you don't mind, his art practice was dealing with multiples. If he had room to do 100 of these on the same wall and there's a space, maybe he would have. I don't know. In terms of, so what was the first part of the question? Why are there two? Well, I think it's just part of dealing with his association with multiples. That, like I said, I'm not historic on this. You know, I have to tell you something. Here's another story. And this is, I can tell you honestly, don't know. Because someone asked, when I heard the original curator talk about this show several weeks ago, and one of the things as we were walking out, there was two or three people that had a couple questions. And I said, what about the motorcycles? And this is a guy that's written books on Warhol. This guy spent a lot of time lecturing on it, curating shows. He looks at it and goes, I don't know. I think that's totally acceptable. I'm saying there's a certain part that happens in an artist's studio that even the curators that have read everything about them don't know. I can only speculate. It has to deal with his practice, how he's dealing with multiples, how he's dealing with his religious beliefs, partly scale, things like that. Okay. I wish I could answer that, but
I think what we see in this room is duality.
Yeah.
I think multiples for sure are yeah. there. But I didn't ever realize the impact of duality. And that's what that is. You know, that there's light on down the middle, and there's the double Christ, and you know, there's the double weight.
Sure. What she's saying is kind of this representation of duality in this room where there's two there. These are almost like a diptych in this panel. This one's almost sliced down with the logo in the center and very much with the two weightlifters. I think maybe, you know, that's another great point where we don't potentially know the way an artist is practicing. It could be dealing with these two parts of his life, a very private life, which no one really knew about until after he died, how no one really had been to his private residence. They didn't know about his partners. They didn't know about his relationship with his mother necessarily until after he died, when his diary started to happen. So
it goes back to the Rorschach test.
Yeah, very much looking for the extra meaning, kind of dealing with these issues. Okay. So looking from here, obviously we're dealing with another iconic figure, the portrait of Jesus. You know, again, dealing with these multiples and kind of, you know, where is he at kind of in the final stages of his life. So what I'd say right now is let's if there's any questions, let's ask a few questions in here because we're going to go to a really small room and we're not going to be able to see each other after this. Anybody? You kidding me? Nothing? All right. Okay, let's go to the next two. Yeah. No, he's very much into logos. Huh? So he's very much into logos. So I'm just
logos.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, I didn't ask
that. We're going to take a right into this room, and we're going to go all the way out to the foyer. I know, we're going to get everybody outside. So what I want everybody to do is walk through this room and actually stand out into the foyer a little bit. If you guys wouldn't mind, we'll keep on walking. There'll be space in this room for a lot of people, but actually if you just go right outside also, just extend past it, there's plenty of room. And then
but Sin No More, it doesn't say that that's a collaboration.
There's Basquiat on that.
Basquiat.
Yeah, there's Basquiat. There's Warhol. Not Clemente on that
Warhol.
One. Definitely Warhol on that one.
Really?
Yeah. It's a Warhol show.
No, I know, but it didn't say that on the whole thing.
I think we're fine. If we can get it, you guys can crowd in a little bit more. You know, there's this quote. Warhol was asked what is life about? And, you know, at this point in his life, like I said, we were talking about in the other room, dealing with his own kind of obsession with death and kind of his own relationships with his friends and his family. His answer to what is life about, he says, you get sick and you die. You just got to stay busy until you get there. I'm paraphrasing a little bit. So I think he was definitely aware, like, so this is 1986, these paintings in this room. He died in 1987. I really like the way the show is curated because it comes full circle, dealing with his own psychology. Again, I'm looking at self-portraits, very much like I said before, I'm calling them self-confrontations because you're definitely going to have to address yourself, not, like I said, not only representational, but with lots of other elements. We're looking at, between the camouflage paintings and kind of the ones behind you, three very distinct portraits, but I think dealing with a very different psychology with happening within a very short time, within a year. Going back to the idea of art practice, how can you determine what an artist is going to make, the marks that they're going to make? You would think, hey, within a course of a month, a course of a year, he should be making similar marks. I'm telling you, it doesn't happen that way. I don't know why I just thought this. On a very extreme tangential way, when I first got to Dallas, I was making work and doing some other things, and all of a sudden, it started raining a lot here, and I'm from Los Angeles, it doesn't rain a lot, so all of a sudden, this is a silly story, but I'm telling you anyway, all these crickets started coming inside of my studio, and they were dying everywhere, and I could have just like shuffled them up and just kind of thrown them away. I didn't do that. I kind of kept them in a big pile. Okay, I have my own obsessions with kind of death, morality, and my own identity. It just happens, okay? So all of a sudden, I'm shuffling all these big crickets into big piles, and I start making drawings. I spent probably about two weeks making dozens of drawings on these little sheets of paper. Anything I've ever shown, everything I've ever advertised and shows, you're never going to see a dead cricket, okay? It hasn't happened yet. Why would I make those? I was curious that day. So all of a sudden you can look at an artist and say, look, was he curious that day? What kind of compelled him to do their work? And so, look, I'll tell you, in this group right now, 5 years from now, you see dead crickets, this is where it happened. I don't know why I made them, but it was just a kind of an experiment. It was a kind of a curiosity of what is around me. I think as artists, the word I like to use, not necessarily as artists, dealing in cultural production. Our job is to kind of respond to what's around us, reassess it, and kind of reinterpret it in hopefully an interesting way, almost like a historian would. And I think also for that cultural production, we need to allow artists to do that because it's saying 2010, this is what's happening. This is what's happening in the world. And how do we kind of respond to that 10 years from now? So that's kind of my ideas in terms of the way artists make work. Hopefully kind of it's a better understanding in terms of what Warhol was doing, what happens in artist's studio in terms of art practice and also cultural production. And so I'll take questions, but thank you for being here. I would be just a little offended if no one had one question at least.
The eggs in the public galleries over, some of the eggs were colored, some of them were black and white, some of the pieces are just black and white, some are colored.
The question is, going back to the eggs, why are some of them black and white? Why are some of them colored? Again, it's coming into art practice for me. I can only address it from art practice, not historically. We know Warhol was intensely good at color, okay? And he could have been balancing those colors for those reasons. Just a small little side fact that I know that he used to make little drawings of like Easter eggs and things like that. He used to hand them out as gifts. So all of a sudden this collective idea, 20 years later, all of a sudden says, wait a minute, I'm readdressing not only my history and my own biography, I'm bringing it back in. So to come back to why would he be making these kind of colored eggs versus black and white eggs, I would guess they would have a slightly different meaning to him. I think he was still addressing them metaphorically, but the weight of black and white, the starkness of that, dealing with how other colors respond, he was probably addressing it a different way. The same way we're looking at three paintings that were made within the same year are very, very different. Okay.
And that one big Basquiat collaboration with the 50.
Yep. The question is, does the Basquiat with the 50 have any significance? I'm going to use an answer that a very esteemed person that curated the show used. I don't know, okay? I wish I could answer. I mean, but I think that's the intriguing part when we actually look at objects and we look at paintings. We have to be able to kind of understand. We place ourselves in a historical context when someone is making the work, and we can. It's part of it's speculation, but part of it is we can explain, and part of it is actually the experience of actually standing this close to a painting and understand it. I also invite everybody, besides the collaboration test I told you about, when you next time you get to a place where someone's making a painting, maybe not in a museum like this, but somewhere else, actually stand close to a painting and experience the painting on the surface. Because you have to realize, we all have to stand back 8-10 feet to see a painting like this. The process doesn't happen 8 or 10 feet away. The process happens right here, and this is where experience happens for the person that's making the objects. So definitely you have to understand this one doesn't have it, but you can see the drips. You can see kind of how the paint kind of globs up. You can see things that happen. And so you have to place yourself, wait a minute, this painting was made 50 years ago or 100 years or 200 years ago. I can feel the person actually standing there and actually putting the paint down. So I think it's a new way to kind of, you should definitely, when you look at paintings, not to say, okay, great, I like the colors, they're pretty, may match over my couch if I owned it, kind of thing like that. It's more than that. It's that dialogue, what's happening collectively in our history, and also the object actually standing there. Being an artist is a lonely practice. You spend lots of time alone. But you know, I would say I'm fairly social, and I spend a lot of time having these dialogues. That's where those ideas happen. Inspiration, few and far between. If someone says it happens, I don't know. It doesn't work for me. Comes in ideas. Ideas happen when you have dialogues with your community. And so in terms of getting back to my idea of cultural production, that's when work happens. And so you should be able to experience it kind of the same way. And kind of my little diatribe there. Yes. Yeah, great. The question is, where would we be, if I can paraphrase this correctly, where would we be without Andy Warhol, and where would we? How does our generation look at Andy Warhol? I think there's several parts that I can answer, partly for myself and partly for my friends and peers who also kind of make objects. I was thinking that I'm going to answer kind of with my own kind of question. I was thinking, because my work deals heavily with identity-based issues, very different than what Warhol does, I was thinking, wait a minute, we have so many reality TV shows, so much kind of like Facebook, so much kind of personal information that's put out there. How would Warhol respond to that? Would his head just explode and say, wait, there's just too much celebrity, there's too much out there? Or would he find a new way to kind of address it? Would he go back to making films? Would he go back to, we don't know, that's all speculation. So that's why I kind of respond a little bit for myself, but how do we look at it? I can answer as a younger artist, looking at his work, and potentially as we kind of, as even collectors and art appreciators in this room, he was an original, okay? He invented a new version of commerce for us. He invented a new kind of standard and kind of productivity and kind of the proclivity that he had. He's kind of created a new standard. What we don't know necessarily in his life is, when I was reading up on his work a little bit more, he had a lot of shows that just got panned, okay? And as an artist, to kind of continue to make work and kind of experiment and to be brave enough to do that is really kind of valid to me. But where would we be without him, and how do we kind of look at him? I think he kind of set a new standard. Like, Damien Hirst wouldn't be selling what he's selling without someone like a Warhol in terms of dealing with pop culture. I mean, it was addressed at the time, but he kind of exploded. Would we have reality TV shows without Warhol? I don't know. Would we have Facebook without him? I don't know. I think it all comes into speculation, but I think we owe kind of Warhol kind of a big kind of gratitude in terms of being just ballsy enough to just kind of make what he was going to make and on the level that he was making it and the quantity that he was making it. Because that had a big kind of part into dealing with in terms of consumerism, how art practices happen. Should the guy be lonely in his studio? Should he have like 25 people around him collaborating? You know, we all know the stories about his factory and collaborations. But look, the guy's in charge. He knows what he's doing. Of course you're going to have assistants to kind of do things like that. But I think it changed not only art practice, it changed how we worked. It looked at the commerce, from my viewpoint, the commerce of the art business. Okay? Yes?
Would that be 60s or 70s art? Or
60s or 70s art for him?
I mean, kind of representing the time.
For Warhol? He started his kind of major art practice when he started to be very aware. And again, this is all in history. Early in the 60s, okay? He died in 1987. What this show represents is the last 10 years. And this is why I really, really like this show. It gets to the point where it's not his familiar work, necessarily, some of it. You know, everybody knows the first five... what we all need to know in this room is the first 5 years is all the work that we know. I don't know how many people thought they can come here and see a ton of soup cans, a ton of, like, you know, flowers, stuff like that. It's not that. That happened very early in his career. So for him to kind of spend the next 30 years and being brave and put out these shows that are getting panned left and right, very brave of him, you know? But he was kind of in his own right. I think he was very much driven to kind of make objects, very much for that whole idea of, like, you know, seeing that Jackson Pollock, because he's the greatest living artist. You know, we all have ego. We all want that a little bit, you know, all of us in this room, to our own kind of respective kind of careers. We want to be known for something. So that's the history a little bit.
How did he die?
A really fast history lesson. He died. He actually he went in for a very routine gallbladder surgery. Shouldn't have died. There was an operation, and then he died from that.
Yeah. Maybe he had
premonitions of dying. Or I don't know. You know, the question was, did he have premonitions of dying? I can't answer that. Maybe he did. In terms of as an artist, you address yourself every day. You address your biography every day. I use that word a lot in my practice. I deal with a lot of biography. He was certainly aware. He was certainly aware of the highs and falls of his career. He's very self-aware. All artists are. We all are. I think we're just in tune to it. So did he have a premonition? I don't know. But when people around him are dying and his own health is failing, he's going to be rethinking his life. Yeah, I'm guessing. Any other questions? No? Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.